Let me just say this. I was brought up in Chalmette, but I was born in Araby, which is uptown Chalmette. So it kind of makes me look a little bit better. I'm going to talk a little fast tonight, and I'm going to talk with this accent. This goes along with it. Well, I got to tell you a quick story. I had a lady come in my office in Huntersville, North Carolina, and she said, "Where are you from, Dr. Joel?" She said, "What part of St. Bernard Parish are you from?" And I said, I'm from Chalmette. I said, "Where are you from, darling?" She said, "From Slidell." And just typical, and you don't appreciate it because you live here. When she left, she said, "Come here, give me a hug." You see, we don't hug over there. I miss y'all. South Louisiana has the greatest people in the world. It's such a privilege and an honor to be here and to be able to talk to y'all. What I want to talk to you tonight about is evolution, creation. And I didn't know what to do, so I said, you know what I'm going to do? A shotgun. I'm going to get a smattering of everything and try to answer some questions that you may have, try to give you some information, and try to cover as much of the topic as I can, especially with emphasis on the things that are being asked so much right now. The whole issue of creation versus evolution. A lot of people have this misconception that when we talk about creation versus evolution, we're discussing science versus religion. And is that really what the topic is? Is it their science versus our religion? The answer is absolutely not. Let me just show you something. If you pick up a high school textbook, and I did that with my son's high school textbook this year, science has certain things that it has to do. The definition of science in this high school textbook says that it's repeatable, observable, and if it's repeatable and observable, it involves things that occur in the present. Well, does that fit evolution? Is evolution really science? Well, as far as I know, evolution supposedly occurred in the past. Nobody's seeing evolution now. Nobody's seeing a snake turn into a bird. There's no snurds anywhere. So evolution, not repeatable by any means that we know of, it's not occurring right now in the present, and nobody's observed it. Evolution fails the definition of science just in your high school textbooks. Well, if it occurred in the past, then maybe it's history. Well, history does occur in the past. History is not repeatable, but history requires an eyewitness. And again, we come down to this problem that nobody sees that macroevolution. Nobody sees one kind of creature turning into another kind of creature. Evolution fails the definition of both science and history. So what's left? Sir Karl Popper is an evolutionist and a philosopher. In fact, a man who won the Nobel Prize for science, Dr. Peter Medawar, said that Sir Karl Popper was the greatest philosopher of science who ever lived. Let's listen to the greatest philosopher of science who ever lived and see what he says evolution is. Karl Popper said, quote, "I have come to the conclusion that Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program, a possible framework for testable scientific theories. Now, to the degree that Darwinism creates the same impression, it is not so very much better than the theistic view of adaptation. It is therefore important to show, watch this, that Darwinism is not a scientific theory, but metaphysical." Well, what is metaphysics? Metaphysics is a philosophy that deals with the origin of everything, that deals with how we live our life, how we base our beliefs. Metaphysics has nothing whatsoever to do with science. It's a belief or a faith. It's a religion. And other evolutionists have realized this. Dr. H.S. Lipsom, professor of physics, University of Manchester in England, said, in fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. When we look at evolution, we're looking at a metaphysical research program. It's not a matter of their science versus our religion. It's a matter of their religion versus our religion. Evolution, in the truest definition, is a religion. In fact, there's only two religions in the world. Dr. G. James Kennedy, Coral Ridge Church out in Florida, pointed out that there are only two religions, Christianity and evolution. And then he corrected himself. He said, no, there are only two religions, biblical Christianity and evolution. You see, biblical Christianity is the only religious belief that says that's based upon a creator, that's based upon man becoming a new creation. 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature, a new creation. Every other religious belief says, no, man is picking himself up by the bootstraps. He's getting bigger and better. He's evolving higher and higher, regardless of what that religion teaches. Biblical Christianity is the only creation-based religion. Every other religious belief, in somehow or another, is founded upon evolution. And why does that make a difference? Since we're dealing with their religion versus our religion, does it really have an impact on society? Absolutely. Not because I say so, but because God himself says so. You see, God told us that as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. People act based upon their beliefs. And this is where the religion of evolution makes all the difference in the world and society we live in. It makes a difference when I walk out of my door in the morning. It makes a difference when I drive down the street. It makes a difference when my kids go to school. and when we interact with other people, because people are going to act based upon what they think and what they believe. And the two belief systems and actions that come out of evolution, our creation, are totally different. When we believe in a creation-based faith, biblical Christianity, then we believe that there is a creator God. If there's a creator God, then God is the owner. I've done some research with a new obesity drug. I patented that drug. The government recognized I have a right as the creator to own it. Well, if God is the creator, who owns us? God does. Who makes the rules? God does. The absolute right and the absolute wrong comes from that creator. You know why? Because he knows. That's one of the problems. I had a television, it was a Magnavox, and I kept trying to fix it based upon a Zenith owner's manual. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? You see, if God is a creator, then he knows how to make me work. The absolute rights and the absolute wrongs that come from God are based upon his knowledge as the one who created things. Finally, if God is a loving creator, wouldn't I expect him to make those rules for my own benefit? What about homosexuals? Say, oh, well, God's just trying to ruin our fun. No, he's not. You just don't know enough. You didn't know about AIDS. You see, a loving creator has the right, the power, the authority to make the rules, and that's exactly what you would expect him to do for your own good. What about the other religious belief? What if evolution is true? If evolution is true, who is man responsible to? Absolutely no one. Man gets to make the rules. Morality comes from my opinion. In fact, if I can get a majority of the people to agree with me, I can change the laws. I can change what's right and wrong. If the majority of the Supreme Court says, hey, it's perfectly all right to kill children, almost born or pre-born, then we've just changed morality. When man gets to make his own rules, here's the dangerous part. Man will justify anything in his own mind. Man is capable of incredible cruelty. Go to Germany in the late 1930s and the mid-1940s, and it's inconceivable that any group of people, physicians, would be that cruel. The most educated people on the face of the earth killed over 20 million people. This is what happens. This is the difference between a creation-based belief system and an evolution-based belief system. It's not just a matter of science and religion and different types of science interpretation of data. It has a tremendous effect on how we live our lives. It has a tremendous effect on the crime rate. It has a tremendous effect on how people live. Problem with religion, evolution, is that right is what you get away with, wrong is what you get caught at, just as long as you don't inhale. Does that sound familiar? You know why I put that in there? Now, that was more appropriate about 4 years ago, but think about it. It doesn't start at the bottom, does it? Where does it start? It starts at the very top. And you know why we call those people leaders? Because they set examples for us and our kids. This is why this whole concept of creation evolution is so important. And just one more thing on religion. I know I'm dragging this out, but I want to show you that the evolutionist understands it. It's not that they're saying science versus religion. They're telling us that, lying, hoping that we'll believe it. But they know what it is. This is a quote by Jeremy Rifkin. He's a quasi-scientist. He writes a lot of books on New Age thinking. But listen what he says. Quote, evolution is no longer viewed as a mindless affair. Quite the opposite. We no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existing cosmic rules. It is our creation now. We make the rules. We establish the parameters of reality. We create the world. And because we do, we no longer feel beholden to outside forces. We no longer have to justify our behavior. For we are the architects of the universe. We are responsible for nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Is that incredible? This man is an evolutionist, but you know what? More so than a lot of Christians I speak to, he understands. As Dr. Francis Schaeffer used to say, he really understands. He understands that the battle is not science versus religion. He understands that the battle is their religious belief versus our religious belief. It's their metaphysical foundation versus ours. And the issue then comes down to this. If it's evolution versus biblical Christianity, if you were an evolutionist, what would you attack? Not Christianity. You would attack biblical Christianity. And the whole debate is one simple thing. Biblical veracity. Is the Bible true? And people attack the Bible in the very first verse. And I've known that ever since I got saved living here in New Orleans. When I would try to share the gospel with people and I talk to them, the objections always came back to the very same book, the book of Genesis. And people would look at me and say, Dr. Roy, you don't really believe that in the beginning God created, do you? And I'd be honest, I'd say, well, no, I believe in a Big Bang explosion. They'd say, Dr. Roy, you don't really believe in ape men, do you? Or you don't really believe that Adam and Eve were the first man and the first woman? What about ape men? Look at professional wrestlers, there have to be ape men, right? He said, Dr. Roy, wait a minute. Now, you tell me that there's a worldwide flood 4,500, 4,300 years ago that killed everybody but 8 people? How can you get 6 billion people in 4,500 years? Can't. I said, geez, and Pete. And it would always end up with the same question, what I call the Genesis excuse. He said, Dr. Roy, if the Bible lies in the very first verse, how can you trust any of the rest of it? And you know what I said? Nothing. Because I didn't have any answers. Started getting some books, started doing a little bit of research, trying to answer those questions. And let me just say this, because I know what y'all are thinking. Dr. Roy, that's not true. There's folks out there that know John 3:16. They see it at the football game every week. People have no idea what that means. They think that's John Madden's weight. This is the only verse that they understand. This is where the battle is, and this is exactly where it's going to be right now. Through the 20th century and on, the battle's going to be in that first book of the Bible, especially the first 11 chapters, because that's where the questions come from, especially young people. Kids in my church, they're always coming up to me. They want to know, Dr. Rod, how do dinosaurs fit with that Bible? How do you get those dinosaurs in the Bible account? Did Noah take dinosaurs on the ark? And if so, how could he fit those great big dinosaurs in that little bitty P-roll? Whatever happened to the dinosaurs? I mean, did they come off the ark? Did they go in the ark? How could Noah fit all the other animals on the ark? Which put those big dinosaurs in there, there's not a lot of room. And how did Noah go out and collect all those animals? How did he know? Adults ask you totally different questions. They want to know, where did Cain get his wife? Teenage boys want to know, did Adam and Eve have belly buttons? I don't know why. People are always at, and I get, well, I used to have the privilege of lecturing at LSU in Baton Rouge every semester with Campus Crusade for Christ. I would have college students, second year college students, come up and ask me this question. How can you believe that the earth is young when we have carbon-14 that dates those rocks to be millions and billions of years old? And how can you see starlight billions of light years away? If it took billions of light years for that starlight to get here, and the earth says that the earth from the universe is very young, thousands of years, how can you see stars that are billions of light years away? And what's the evidence for Noah's flood? How can people live to be 930 years old? You know what happens when we can't answer those questions? We start to have questions of our own. We start to get doubts in our mind. And we start asking, well, wait a minute. Are the days in Genesis really what God said? Are they 24-hour days? Could they be geologic epics? Could they be billion-year periods? Is there a gap maybe between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2? Did God create everything in Genesis 1:1 and then destroy it and then rebuild it again in Genesis 1:2? And why did God take 6 days? I mean, he's God. Couldn't he have just done that and created it instantaneously? Where do the different races come from? Why do people have all these different physical characteristics spread out all over the world? When were angels created? Noah's flood, local or gigantic? You know what Peter tells us to do with those questions? Be ready always to give an answer to everyone that asks you. And those are the tough questions. Those are the questions that I get most often, even to this day. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to take a little time to go through this. And I know some of you have heard this before, but for some of you, it'll just be a review. Some folks, I might be answering these questions for the first time, to give you answers so that, and this is where it really does count. Gentlemen, you know who the Bible gives the responsibility for teaching our children and the nurturing the admonition of the Lord? Man, that's our responsibility. When our kids ask these questions, it's our responsibility to answer them. Let me give you some answers that you can share that with your kids tonight. Number one. Oh, to show you one other thing. Did you read Hosea 4:6? My people are destroyed for lack of... No. People are destroyed for air-conditioned buildings and lack of adequate parking. God says, I want you to know. Let me help you. Dinosaurs in the Bible. Did they really exist? Were they really dinosaurs? Where did they come from? More important, where did they go? And are they all extinct? Sure, dinosaurs existed. We know that dinosaurs existed because we find these things, fossils. And it's funny because we find fossils of dinosaurs all over the place. You find them at the bottom of the ocean. You find them along riverbanks. You find them at the tops of mountains. So we know that dinosaurs did exist because we find fossils. This is a fossil of a plesiosaur. Technically, it's not a dinosaur. It lived in the water, but supposedly along that same line. So we know that dinosaurs exist because we find fossils. But the big question is not really did they exist. Yes, they did. Where did they come from? Where did those dinosaurs come from? Well, for the evolutionists, that's kind of a problem. As you read books on evolution, I'm going to show you one in particular. Evolutionists have no idea where the dinosaurs came from. Barry Koch, in his book entitled Mysteries of Early Dinosaur Evolution, the article that he wrote in Nature magazine, said, although many pages have been written discussing the mystery of the extinction of the dinosaurs, almost as much uncertainty surrounds their origin or origins. Uncertainty. Barry Cox is saying, we're really not sure where dinosaurs come from. And there's a reason why he says that. See, dinosaurs are confusing. They come in two flavors. They come in the regular reptile flavor that has a normal reptilian hip, but they also come in a group of dinosaurs that have a bird-type hip bone. Now, if they evolved, there ought to be a creature before these guys showing that hip bone, or at least one of those hip bones, evolving into another. and some animals in between them coming together showing a combination of features in the fossil record. Do we find that? Again, here's the problem, and that's what Barry Cox is saying. If one now attempts to relate these two types of dinosaurs to the Triassic pseudosuchians, the critter that it was supposed to evolve from, there appears to be a puzzling overlap in time between the two groups. Possible evolutionary links between them obstinately refuse to appear. Y'all, I'm sorry, I'm a physician. When I don't have evidence for a disease, I don't diagnose it. That's exactly what this evolutionist is saying. You know what? There's no evidence for this evolution. We just got to believe it. So the mystery of dinosaur evolution to the evolutionist is still a mystery. But for me, it's not. I'm a Christian. I have a book that claims to be the word of someone who knows everything, who's seen everything, who's always been there. And it's someone who says he cannot lie. And he says, I'm going to tell you exactly where the dinosaurs came from. Things like the plesiosaur that live in water I've created on day... What day? Five, yeah. He said everything that lived in water I created on day five. He said things that live on land, like Tyrannosaurus Rex, I created on day six, along with Adam and Eve. Well, wait a minute, Dr. Rod. Tyrannosaurus Rex lived with Adam and Eve. Wouldn't he eat them? Ken Ham asked this question a long time ago about things that occur in the past. And it's the right question. Were you there? Did you ever see Tyrannosaurus Rex eat anything? You see, a lot of people think that Tyrannosaurus Rex was a carnivorous animal, that he ate meat because he had big, long, sharp teeth. But now, wait a minute. Fruit bats from Australia and New Zealand have big, long, sharp teeth. They only eat fruit. Bears, if they can get a full vegetarian diet, big, long, sharp teeth, but they'll eat just fruit. There have been lions that we've had in captivity that only eat hay and straw. You know what big, long, sharp teeth mean? Big, long, sharp teeth, that's all. Just because you have big, long, sharp teeth doesn't mean that you've got to be a meat eater. In fact, Dr. Gary Parker cited some other research that said when you look at a Tyrannosaurus Rex tooth, yes, it is serrated, no question about it, but it's a very long tooth and a very shallow socket. And if Tyrannosaurus Rex had bitten into an animal and yanked, he'd have pulled all his teeth out. They didn't have to gum animals to death, and nobody believes that. When you start with the word of someone, watch this now, if you start with the word with someone who knows everything, who's always been that, and who cannot lie, you've got a perfect witness. When you start with the word of somebody like that, and you go out and look for the evidence, shouldn't the evidence be there? Sure. We found Tyrannosaurus Rex skulls and teeth in Texas with sugarcane fossilized between the teeth. Why would that make sense from a biblical standpoint? Because God tells me exactly what Tyrannosaurus Rex ate at the very beginning. God says in Genesis 1:30, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps in the earth in which there is life, I've given them every green herb for food. So the sugarcane between the teeth sort of fits exactly with what God says. You see, Tyrannosaurus Rex teeth were not great for pulling on flesh. He had excellent teeth for stripping bark off a tree, or stripping sugarcane. Did Tyrannosaurus Rex ever eat meat? Probably later on he did. Because man eventually ate meat. But right at the very beginning, there would have been no problem with Tyrannosaurus Rex and Adam living together simultaneously. Start with God's word, the one who knows everything, who's seen everything. Look at the evidence. See if the evidence fits. Over and over again, that's exactly what we see. What happened to the dinosaurs? Can't go to Audubon Park and see them. Tried today. Where are all the dinosaurs? Whatever happened? We know that dinosaurs existed because we said we find what? Fossils. How do you form a fossil? You have to bury something very quickly with mud and water. Does the Bible talk about any event in Earth history in which things would have been covered very quickly with mud and water all over the place, even at the tops of mountains? Sure. God says there was a worldwide flood. He said at one time, the fountains of the great deep burst forth. And critters all over the Earth would have been covered very, very quickly with mud and water. And that would have formed fossils. Now, my next door neighbor, when I lived in River Ridge, he was an evolutionist. And he said, Mike, he said, what's your evidence for Noah's flood? He had a master's degree in both evolutionary biology and geology. I said, well, Walt, what evidence would you expect to find if there was a worldwide flood? He said, you'd expect to find billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. I said, well, what's the fossil record? He said, billions of dead things buried by rock layers all over the earth. I said, well, you see, it's just like the evidence fits with God's word. He said, well, yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it? You see, when I start with the word of someone who knows everything, who's always been there, who's seen everything, and you look for the evidence, it's right there. The fossils at the top of Mount Everest, on the top of the Himalayan plateau, what kind of fossils do we find up there? Seashells, fish. Jeez, it's a big flood. Covered the highest mountains. When we look at what happened to the dinosaurs, many of them must have been destroyed in Noah's flood because most of those fossils were formed by the mud and water covering those dead creatures during Noah's flood. Catastrophic burial. Now, when I was in high school, and it's changed, so this is good news. When I was in high school, we were taught that fossils were formed when things were buried with mud and water over millions or hundreds of millions of years. And that doesn't make any sense. If you bury something very slowly with mud and water, are you going to get a fossil or is it going to rot? Okay, no, do an experiment. Go home, get a dead cat, put it in your front lawn, explain to the neighbors, this is an experiment. Leave that dead cat there for 6 months. What happens? Do you get a fossil or does it disappear? Yeah. Things eat it, drag it away, the bones dissolve. You end up with nothing. If you're going to farm a fossil, you have to bury things with mud and water. How? Quickly, catastrophically. This is my favorite. Here's a picture of a perch fossilized in the act of swallowing a herring. Now, y'all, my wife's a slow eater, but this is ridiculous. This didn't take a million years. This happened catastrophically, suddenly. When we look at the fossil record, that's what we're looking at. Sudden catastrophic burial all over the earth, even at the tops of mountains. Well, if that's what happened to the dinosaurs, did they miss the boat? Did they actually go on Noah's Ark? Did they not go because he couldn't fit them on there? Who knows everything? Who's always been there? Who's seen everything? Who can't lie? God. And God tells us exactly whether or not the dinosaurs went on board the boat. He told Noah to take two of every land-dwelling, air-breathing creature. Did dinosaurs go on board that boat? You betcha. How'd he get those great big animals in there? Had a little girl, I was doing a conference in St. Louis one time, and I got to this part, and I asked that question. She was about, oh, I guess she must have been about 7, 8 years old. She raised her hand. Boy, she was confident. She looked at me, she said, helicopters, Doc. Big Chinook helicopters. Drop them puppies right in. No. The answer's simple. Y'all know this. Noah didn't bring big dinosaurs on board the boat, right? He brought teenage dinosaurs. He brought young adults. And that would make sense. You see, reptiles grow throughout their lifespan, however fast they grow. If you see a 25-year-old alligator, you're probably looking at a 20-foot alligator or a 20-foot crocodile. If things before the flood lived to be 900 years old, people before the flood lived to be very, very old ages, and you've got a 900-year-old reptile, then you've got a big, gigantic reptile. God wouldn't tell Noah to bring that on board the ark. God would bring just a smaller dinosaur, which answers the other question. How did Noah collect all those animals? Did Noah collect the animals? No. You see, God's the genius in this thing. God went out and got the animals. God knew to pick smaller dinosaurs, the creatures that he wanted, and he brought them to Noah. Now, dinosaurs went on board the ark. Who got off the ark? Dinosaurs, where are they? Shouldn't those dinosaurs be out there someplace? Job was writing after the flood. Listen to what he says. Job 40, 15 through 18. He says, look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. His strength is in his hips, his power in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. He says, his bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. What creature has a tail like a cedar? Dinosaur-type creature. Dinosaurs have tails like creatures. What Job is describing is a good description of a dinosaur. Now, I've read different Bible commentaries on this. One Bible commentary said it's an elephant. That's the wrong end of the elephant. Another one said it's a hippopotamus. This guy's never seen a hippopotamus tail. This can only be something like this creature. And I put this up here because we still have reports to this day of creatures like this living in the Congo and living in South America. So there are people around the world that have seen these creatures. And we have reports of people who have seen things like dinosaurs post-flood. Herodotus, the Greek historian, 4th century B.C., gave a perfect description of a Rhamphorhynchus flying dinosaur. Let me show you this. This, I think, is incredible. This is Dr. Don Patton, and when he presented this, I was a little skeptical. I did a little research. He's right. There are Incan potteries from Peru that date back to 400 A.D. to 1500 A.D., that show interesting creatures on these pottery figures. And hold on now, I've got to get this focused. Because I do want you to see this. Can you see that this is a Triceratops? Yeah. That particular piece is about 1200 AD. This is a Diplodocus, but it's these dermal frills on the back that are real peculiar. You see, it wasn't until 1991, 92 that we realized that these dinosaurs had those things. But whoever did this pottery back in the 13th century knew it. And if you can look at this one, wrong way. This is a man fighting a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Did man and dinosaurs coexist? After the flood. It sure does look like it. So what happened to the dinosaurs? Probably this. You see, dinosaurs appear to be, when Alexander the Great went into India, they gave reports of dinosaurs, and they were pretty belligerent creatures. It appears that dinosaurs just weren't nice at all. And there's a good possibility that these things became extinct at man's hand, slowly, over 1,000 years or more, but that dinosaurs did coexist with man even after the flood. just what God said. Created man and dinosaurs together, went on board the ark, came off the ark, we took care of them. Hang on. Here's another question that Walt asked one day. He said, Mike, he said, I got another question about the flood. I said, go, Walt. He said, how could Noah fit all those billions of animals in that little bitty ark? And how did he collect them all? I got to tell you all this real quick. He had this is a teenager, and we were in Indiana. He said, Doc, I got a question. I said, go ahead. He said, how'd Moses get all them animals on board that ark? I said, Moses. He said, yes, sir. He said, how'd Moses get all them animals in that little bitty boat? I said, son, I said, have you read the Bible? He said, yes. I said, well, if you read the Bible, you realize Moses didn't put the animals on board the ark. He parted the flood and they walked across on dry land. He said, I saw it in the movie. Moses didn't bring any animals on board the ark. Did Noah collect them? God brought them to him. How could he get all of those animals in that little bitty boat? When Walt asked me that question, I asked him two questions. Walt, how big's the ark? He said, I don't know. I said, how many animals did he have to bring? He said, I'm not sure. I said, you cannot fit an unknown number of animals in an unknown size boat. You've got to have some numbers. Let me show you some numbers now. Let's see if it's possible to get all those animals. Do fish have to go in? No. Land-dwelling, air-breathing animals. Do insects have to go in? No. Land-dwelling, air-breathing animals survive floating on top of the trees and bark and leaves that are going to float during the flood. So Noah doesn't have that many critters to bring in as we originally thought. How big was the boat? Big. 437 feet long, 73 feet wide, 44 feet high. Three decks. You could fit 125,000 animals, average size of a sheep, on board Noah's Ark. How many critters had to go in? When Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. John Wickham wrote the book, The Genesis Flood, back in 1969, they said they would have to bring at least 20,000 creatures, maybe as many as 50,000 creatures, accounting for extinct critters. Dr. Kurt Wise, who got his PhD under Stephen Jay Gould at Harvard, recalculated and he said, wait, that's way too high. He said the most, absolute most creatures you'd have to bring is about 8,000, maybe as little as 2,000 to 5,000 creatures, which means that you would take up less than 5% of the boat. You had tremendous amount of room for other people, for food, for other things that other people had wanted to come on board the ark. It's not a matter of how could you get all those things on board the ark, it's what did they do with all the empty space. There was a lot there. More questions on the flood. Why are there no human fossils from the flood? And this is something a lot of people wonder. I think primarily because God did what he said he was going to do. Remember what God said about the flood? He said, I sent the flood to wipe man from the face of the earth. And I think he did. I don't think that there's much or any evidence from pre-flood man. I think God fulfilled his promise that he was going to do that. Furthermore, humans kind of headed to the high ground. Humans were smart. They could see that flood water rising. They would keep getting higher and higher up until they finally ran out of room, and they would drown. When they drowned, they were on the uppermost things, tops of mountains and hills, and what happened at that point in time, they floated on top of the water. Critters ate them, fish ate them, bacteria took care of them, so that there was nothing left there to fossilize. That's why we don't find any remains of humans, pre-flood. Now, with regard to the ark, more questions. Are all the fossils from Noah's flood? I don't think so. See, how did God get all that water off the earth? God says that he pushed the ocean basins down and he raised up the land. So even after the flood, he was probably still creating gigantic geologic movement so that we would have large local floods after the flood. Some of the fossils that we see in the fossil record, not the majority, but some of them, are probably due to large local floods that occurred after Noah's flood. Was the flood a local flood? Absolutely not. God said that he covered every high mountain. Everything was covered. The flood just did not occur in the Middle East. The flood was all over the world. Everything was destroyed. And if only 8 people survived, how could you get 6 billion people in the world in only 4,500 years? And how do you get this racial variation, different color skin, different shape eyes, different body features from all these different people? Well, a lot of that relates to the science of genetics and God being a good engineer. You see, if God was a good engineer, he wouldn't bring 2 of every dog on board the ark. He would bring 2 of every dog kind, male and female. He would get 2 mongrel dogs that had the genetic ability to reproduce every type of dog, everything in the family candidate, from a wolf to a chihuahua to a great dane. And when these creatures came off the ark, they would start breeding, they would start expressing all this variety in the genes, and before you knew it, you would have all different types of dogs within just a few generations. God wouldn't take a tool chest on board the ark, he'd take a Swiss Army knife. The same thing would occur with humans on board the ark. Let me just do this, because we always do this with skin color. skin color is controlled by two genes in the skin, by four genes in the human body that control how much melanin is in the skin. And people wonder, well, how do you get dark-skinned people in Africa, Australia, India? How do you get people in Africa that have different physical characteristics associated with dark skin? People in India have those big moon-shaped eyes, and people in Australia look basically like what we would call Caucasians with dark skin. How do you isolate those characteristics? The dark skin would occur this way, or just the different colors in skin that we see. These four genes, if Noah's sons and daughter-in-laws, three sons, three daughter-in-laws, had the maximum genetic variety in their body, when they married, started having children after the flood, they would produce kids that had the maximum genetic variety. So within one or two generations, you would have kids running around that range from the lightest light to the darkest dark. And it would all be in that one geographic area. But that's not what we see, is it? We see the darkest dark isolated in different areas. We see the lightest light isolated in different areas. How would God isolate those physical characteristics? The same way we do it today. God would isolate people based on language. Does the Bible talk about anything that would separate people based upon language? Sure does. At the Tower of Babel, God separates people with similar genetic qualities. These people migrate to different lands. Folks that had real light skin, real blue eyes, kept going north. People that had real dark skin went south and went east. There were some people that had a little genetic mutation. They had more dissolved fat in their skin. It appeared yellow, but they also allowed more dissolved fat in their eyelid, and they lost their epicanthal fold, so they had slanty eyes. They kept going way, way east. So you see people isolated based upon those genetic characteristics. And over again, those folks isolate themselves in the same place, they marry people who have similar genetic characteristics, and they keep reproducing people that look like themselves. Does that make sense? You see how God did that? This is exactly what happens. And we call that natural selection. This is why God didn't have to take all those dogs on board the ark. God didn't have to take all those rabbits on board the ark. Somebody asked one time, said, Dr. Rod, there's about 400 different types of rabbits. Did God take them all? No, no. He took male and female bunny that had the genetic variety that when they got off the ark, they produced big rabbits, little rabbits. Rabbits with short ears, rabbits with long ears. White rabbits, black rabbits. White rabbits, brown rabbits. All variety of rabbits. As those rabbits start to spread out, natural selection begins to act. White and brown rabbits would migrate to Alaska. Now, what rabbit can you see in the snow in Alaska? Brown rabbit. Guess what rabbit the wolf can see? Brown rabbit. What rabbit gets eaten? Brown rabbit. So what do you have left in Alaska? Just the white rabbits. White and brown rabbits come to Louisiana. Which one gets eaten? Both of them. Cajuns eat everything. We've got a built-in mechanism through natural selection to get the genetic variety that we see all over the earth. And that theory of natural selection was first proposed not by an evolutionist, but by the Christian creationist Sir Edward Blyth back in 1835. He said if God was a good engineer, if he was a real good engineer, he would put so much variability into those two creatures, male and female, that he put on board the ark, that when he got off the ark, they would breed and they would fill every ecological niche based upon those characteristics that they had. That's exactly what we see. See, God's the brains in the operation. God's the good person. Oh, let me back up and show you one other thing to show you how good an engineer God is. If you look at the dimensions on Noah's ark, this always amazed me. Noah's Ark has a perfect 6-to-1 ratio, length to width. That is the most stable configuration, according to nautical engineers, for stability in a boat. This boat would be virtually impossible to tip over until you've got just about 90 degrees, 89 plus degrees. God's a good engineer. What else can I show you? Oh, what about the origin of the languages? There are many philologists now, and this was in Smithsonian Magazine again recently, that have said, you know what? It looks as if every language comes from an original proto-language. Again, we start with the word of someone who knows everything, who's always been there. We go out and we look for the evidence, and it's there. But that doesn't answer the question that I always had and I always thought was the toughest. If you have a flood 4,300, 4,500 years ago, how can you get 6 billion people in the world in that short amount of time? Well, there are simple equations that we use to calculate growth of population. If you're a microbiologist, you use it to calculate how fast bacteria grow in a petri dish. If you're a politician, you calculate how fast your population is growing. You need to know where to put schools. If you're in Orleans Parish, you need to know whose property to drop property assessment on. I couldn't believe that. But we need to know how fast things are growing. And we can calculate how fast human populations grow by just some simple equations. When you plug in numbers, very conservative numbers. Now, remember, we don't want things living to be real old. We don't want families with three and four kids. if you only assume that a generation lasts about 47 and a half years and that they only have 2.5 children on average per family, within 4,300 years, you would end up with 5.8 billion people. Just what you see. So could you repopulate the earth in 4,500 years with only 3 reproducing couples? Absolutely. The question is, where did everybody else go? We should have a lot more people. But I want you to think about something. The evolutionists are correct. If man's been here hundreds of thousands or even a million years, how populated should the earth be? Yeah. If creatures have been living here for over 100 million years, should we have any resources left? Every square inch of earth, in fact, if you do the calculations, every square inch of the universe should be populated with something. And that's not what we see. We see something that fits more with a biblical scenario of a slow population growth. Do you see what we just did? We just talked about the most important issue that there is in the creation evolution debate. What issue is that? Time. And what most of us are finding right now is this is where the debate is beginning to rage. This whole issue of time. You see, old age is the god of evolution. Billions of years, not millions of years. Evolution has a god, has a foundation upon which everything rests. And it's what Stephen Jay Gould called deep time, old age. Evolutionists need that time. Without that time, then evolution never ever could occur. And they look at old age indicators to try to justify this. And there's been 3 major areas that the evolutionist has absolutely needed. The first one was the geologic column, looking at these layers of rock and saying, gee, it must have taken hundreds of millions of years for those layers of rock to form. Radiometric dating method that dates these rocks, like we talked about, carbon-14, rubidium-strontium, all these methods that give us billion-year dates for the Earth. And finally, and this has been the biggest one, the size of the universe. How can you see that starlight that's billions of light years away? Evolution needs not millions of years, but billions of years. Let me just show you that real quickly. Dr. Herbert Yockey is the Albert Einstein of information theory. And he calculated what could we get given a billion years of evolution with combining chemicals together to form proteins. Everything in your body works on proteins. If you don't have any proteins, you don't exist. So every living thing needs proteins. And Yockey calculated that in a billion years of evolution, the biggest protein that you could get would have only 49 amino acids. You need several hundred just to make the thing work. And he said, you know what, after a billion years, if you could only get one protein with only 49 amino acids, even a billion years of evolution is not nearly enough time. The god of evolution is old age, and even given his billion years, he still doesn't have enough time. Let me just show you a quote by George Wald so that you understand. You see, as Christians, we say, with God, all things are possible. Yeah, but for the evolutionist, it's with time, all things are possible. Time is the god of evolution. I love this quote by George Wald. He says, time is in fact the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal with is of the order of 2 billion years, and really he only has about a billion. He says, what we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, impossible becomes possible. The possible, probable, and the probable, virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the science? No, he said time itself performs the miracles. Isn't it amazing he admits that even with evolution he needs miracles? This is why when you talk to an evolutionist, Stephen Jay Gould admitted, now he was a paleontologist, he was an expert in the fossil record. He said, you know what, when you look at the fossil record, you know what you don't see? You don't see evolution. So you have to come up with a whole other theory. You can speak to evolutionists who are experts. Dr. Richard Lumsden and I went to hear Leslie Argel speak at the University of New Orleans. Argel is an expert on this abiogenesis theory, chemicals coming together to form life. And we went and spoke to Dr. Argel after the lecture, and Dr. Argel said, you're right. He said, there's absolutely no evidence for it. And I love what Dr. Lumsden said at that time. He said, well, Leslie, he said, why do you do this research? He said, they pay me for it. So evolutionists, when they talk about their area of expertise, they will admit, hey, look, I deal with the fossils, there's no evidence. You deal with somebody that deals with abiogenesis, there's no evidence. They will admit that mutations don't cause evolution. Geneticists will freely admit that. But the one thing they will never, ever compromise on is time. Because with time, all things are possible. If you pull the time rug out from evolution, you've destroyed evolution. It is the foundation. And it's tragic because this is the area that they were able to finally crack the foundation of Christians' faith. I'm not talking about non-believers. I'm talking about Christians' faith. This is the place where they've attacked the Scriptures. See, the Bible doesn't say how old things are, but it certainly does imply from Genesis chapter 5 that things are very young. Not millions of years, not billions of years, but in the order of thousands of years. Evolution can't tolerate thousands of years because it never, ever could occur. Evolution needs, not millions, needs actually more than billions and trillions of trillions, but they'll settle for billions. Evolution needs these old age dating methods. They need deep time. How did it get started? How did this whole concept of time, old age, get started? It started right at the geologic column. In the 18th century, 1795, James Hutton publishes a book called Theory of the Earth. It was a breakthrough book. Because in that book, he said, you know what? I see rivers overflow their bank and it builds up a little bitty tiny layer of soil. He said, I see rivers and streams and creeks, sometimes flood water after a rain, will carve out little niches in the soil. He said, I'll bet you that these processes that we see taking place on a very, very tiny scale right now could have gone on for millions and millions and millions of years and produced everything that we see in the geologic column. He said, when I look, and he didn't say Grand Canyon, but he said, possibly at the Grand Canyon, what we're looking at and places like that are the results of hundreds of millions of years of rock building and erosion, forming things like this. He was the first person to introduce this. And it's kind of interesting what happened to James Hutton. He was accused of being an atheist and convicted, and shortly after that, within a couple of years, he was a broken man and he died. Somebody picked up on his ideas, and this gentleman was not a geologist, but he expanded them. This man was critical, Charles Lyell. In a four-year period, Charles Lyell published three volumes, Principles of Geology, in which he said Hutton's right. He said, these ideas that the processes that I see going on right now have gone on forever and ever and ever in the past. We don't need a worldwide flood. That's not true. And if we don't need a worldwide flood, what book's not telling the truth? So this was the first direct attack in the Bible. Guess who read Lyell's book and said, I got an idea? Charles Darwin. You see, Darwin finally had the justification, the time he needed, the millions and billions of years that he needed for evolution to take place. And starting with Lyell's Principles of Geology, stealing the idea from Blythe of natural selection, he came up with a naturalistic account of how we got there. Geology. Let's talk a little bit about the Grand Canyon. What about those layers? Did they take a long time to form? Did they take millions of years to carve out the Grand Canyon? This is the argument that we get from the evolutionists with regard to all of these layers. One thing that's interesting, no matter where we find layers of rock laid down like this, what we never find are fossil meteorites. Now listen, if it took 500 billion years to go from the bottom of the Grand Canyon to the top as far as layering rocks, don't you think some meteorites would have hit that? We have evidence of fossil meteorites in those top layers today. What we don't find as we dig down in the geologic column is any meteorites. It's almost as if those layers formed rapidly. Have we ever seen anything like the Grand Canyon form rapidly? When you go out to the Grand Canyon, the official doctrine is that it took, maybe 20 million years for the Colorado River to carve out the Grand Canyon, and it dumped 2 million tons of sediment in the Gulf of California. A few problems with that. The Colorado River flows from east to west. In order to carve out the Grand Canyon, it would have to flow uphill. Y'all, that's hard. Even in St. Bernard Parish, water goes downhill. Furthermore, you got 2 million tons of sediment that moved out of the Grand Canyon. Where is it? That's a lot of rocks. Those rocks should be right there forming this gigantic delta in the Gulf of California. It's not there. And the rocks in the Gulf of California don't really fit very well with the Grand Canyon. What happened? Have we ever seen anything like this happen? Surely have. This is Mount St. Helens before. This is Mount St. Helens during. And look at Mount St. Helens after. Well, by golly, that looks like a canyon with a little bitty river running down the middle and layers of rock along the side. And those layers of rock now have become discolored. This is an old photograph. We've seen canyons like the Grand Canyon form. Guess how many millions of years this took? Less than 24 hours. See, when Mount St. Helens blew up, it blew up rocks and mud and trees across the Toodle River, and it dammed up that river. And after about a year, the lake got so big behind that dam, the dam broke. And in one day, the water came rushing through this lava flow, and look what it cut. It cut a canyon identical to the Grand Canyon, with the V-shaped side canyons like we see at the Grand Canyon, with these layers of rock, some places as much as 60 meters thick. It's a person down at the bottom, just the scale. At the bottom of Spirit Lake right now, we're finding logs turning into coal. Another eruption, a apply a little bit more heat, and we would have coal formation at the bottom. Some of them have already petrified. In fact, that's what happened to the logging industry over there. See, there was a big, big logging industry. This area was surrounded by trees, and the loggers went in after this, and they said, oh, we don't have to cut these down. All we got to do is chop them up in bite-sized pieces, put them on a truck, and haul them out. They had already begun to petrify. So what we see over there are rapid processes. This is incredible. I had a man tell me I was an idiot because of this. I said, listen, I said, this has been documented, and it's been witnessed. See these layers of rock? Do you think those layers of rock form one on top of the other? Looks like it, doesn't it? This is a pyroclastic mud flow. This is molten rock flowing at 60 miles an hour. And as that rock flowed sideways, horizontally, it layered itself out vertically, just like you see at the Grand Canyon. And you know what's incredible? Guy Bertholdt is a French geologist, and what he showed is that when water and silt is flowing sideways, horizontally, in a direction, it will begin to layer itself out in those layers, just like we see at the Grand Canyon. So, did those layers of rock superimpose themselves? We laid down this one, we came back, we laid down that one, Experimental evidence shows that those layers of rock were probably moving in a direction and got layered one on top of another. Anyway, we don't need millions of years at the Grand Canyon. What we need is a catastrophe, possibly a post-flood catastrophe, just like we saw with Mount St. Helens, to form that time. But now we're into the key area. We're into the area of old age. And this was the area that the evolutionists came at. What was our response as Christians? What did we do? We did just what John Ankerberg has done. We did just what Dr. Hugh Ross has done. We compromised the Word of God. We said, well, this is what God's saying, but it's not what He means. And the compromise that was first proposed was the gap theory. The gap theory said this, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1, Genesis 1:2, and the earth was without form and void. Oh, wait a minute, there's a reason why we got without form and void there in Genesis 1:2. Something must have happened between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 to have the earth just a whole mess. And the gap theory stated that what happened was that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and He also created dinosaurs and a whole bunch of other critters that lived there. He created angels. Satan rebelled. God sent this worldwide flood to destroy the angels and the dinosaurs, a flood that the Bible doesn't say anything about, and that on Genesis 1:2, He's now recreating the earth. That those things had lived there for hundreds of millions of years in that gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. Let me just show you this, just a theological history. In 1814, Thomas Chalmers, University of Edinburgh, proposed the gap theory. He said that there's this long gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. It was purely for geological reasons. It had nothing whatsoever to do with the theology. Because in the Hebrew text, it says, and the earth was without form and void. And any Hebrew scholar, even Hebrew scholars that believe in the gap theory, said, if you just read the Hebrew, you would believe that God was continuing everything on that first day and that there wasn't a gap. 1849 to 1857, Hugh Miller picks this up. He says, you know what? You got too many fossils, which means that there were too many different types of animals to put on board the ark, and therefore the flood had to be a local flood, and he proposed something significant. He's the first guy that says, you know what? Days in Genesis aren't days. It says the first day, second day. He said, but it's not days. He said, those are geological ages. And finally, by 1876 and 1884, George Pember, and these are all Christians, published a book where he popularized the gap theory, and it became solidly entrenched throughout the 20th century. It's rare to find anybody that still believes in the gap theory. But this was the proposal. The gap theory, is there really a gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2? Who am I going to go to? Who knows everything? Who's seen everything? Who's always been there? God, yeah. Let's go to somebody who can't lie. Listen to what he says. Every day, except day two, and there's a reason for that, every day after creation, God looks at what he makes and he says it's what? He says good, except the last day. He didn't say it was good, did he? What did he say? It's very good. Well, gee. If you've got billions of animals that are dead and a whole host of rebellious angels that you created earlier, how could you look at day six and say, oh, it's very good? That doesn't look very good at all. It looks very bad. The gap theory just doesn't fit. In fact, the whole concept of death before Adam doesn't fit. And Adam didn't show up till day six. He's not back there on day one. Not because I say so, because that person that knows everything says so. You see, in Romans 5, 12 and 14, Paul makes it very, very clear, wherefore, as by one man, sin entered into the world. And what's the problem with sin coming into the world? It's not the sin, it's what sin brought with it. It brought what? Death. There's no death for hundreds of millions of years until Adam sins. So that pretty much destroys the gap. He says the same thing in 1 Corinthians 15, 21, 22, for as in Adam all die. John Ankerberg sent me a 4-page letter trying to explain this away and saying that that death doesn't mean death for the world. It says world. Okay, it doesn't mean death of the world, it just means death of man. But it doesn't apply to the creation. Oh yeah? Well, Paul doesn't think so. In Romans 8, Paul says the creation was subject to futility. The creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption. The whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs. Paul sure thought there was a problem with the creation, didn't he? And that problem begins with the last great enemy. At the end of Corinthians, Paul says the last enemy will be destroyed. And that enemy is which one? Death. Paul didn't seem like death was a good thing. So when we look at the gap theory, the problem with the gap theory is not a geological problem. The problem with the gap theory is a theological problem. There's nothing in Scripture that says that there's a gap between 1-1 and 1-2. And if everything's very good on day 6, I don't think there's rebellious angels and billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth all the way back then. Okay. What about the days in Genesis? So the days, little 24-hour days? I'm not going to tell you until we come back from a break. When we come back from a break, we're going to talk about the days of Genesis. We're going to let God say what He's got to say about it. And then we're going to answer the big question that's been the toughest question for all of us to answer. How can you see stars that are billions of light years away?